From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2013, the American College of Cardiology and American Heart Association recommended that almost half of American adults aged 40 to 75 should be on statins to lower their cholesterol and their risk of heart attack and stroke. Two studies published this week support that controversial recommendation. But with so many millions of Americans being urged to take the pills, there's still a lot of scrutiny. This hour on Point, heart health, cholesterol, statins, and what to do. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you on a statin? How's it going? How else are you lowering your cholesterol and your risk of heart attack, stroke? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we will talk about Colorado's big success in reducing teen pregnancy with birth control implants. But first, statins and heart health. Here's how NBC got their viewers' attention with reporter Stephanie Gross last week with the startling stats about heart risk that Americans face.
In the United States, someone has a heart attack every 34 seconds. Every 4 minutes, someone dies from a stroke.
Okay, we're listening. Joining me first today from Bethesda, Maryland, is Melissa Healy, health and medicine reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Melissa, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you, Tom.
New research out on Tuesday, but what it builds on are recommendations that came out in 2013, which I think still remain controversial in some quarters, saying many more Americans should take statins, Lipitor and the generic version, Zocor, Crestor. Take us back for just a second, if you would, Melissa, to 2013. What was recommended then that produced such big numbers of recommended people said should be on statins? What was that recommendation?
Well, Tom, the idea of preventing heart attacks and strokes by treating people for high cholesterol has always been a lightning rod for controversy. The debate's been over very basic questions like whether cholesterol even has anything to do with heart attacks. But in 2013, the real debate became not over whether cholesterol has anything to do with heart attacks. At this point, that's almost become a bit of a consensus. In 2013, the idea was, or the real question became, who should be treated for high cholesterol and how? Basically, you know, should people just be put on a medication and sort of left to live their lives, or should they be monitored, should their reactions, their responses to the medication be monitored, and should their medications be escalated if they didn't respond appropriately, if their cholesterol didn't go down far enough?
So they said, let's take a look at cholesterol, at family history, at age, other factors, and if you've got a risk of 7.5% or higher of heart attack or stroke, then boom, you're on a statin. That gets into big numbers in a hurry. I think there was a study last year that said that would be about half of all Americans, 40 to 75. We're talking, many, many millions there. These are kind of mind-boggling levels of statin use.
Well, it basically would make 48% of the adult American population eligible for taking statins, and compared to the 2004 guidelines that were issued by the American Heart Association, that's another 10 million Americans. So, yeah, that's a lot of Americans.
Many clearly don't listen. Only about 1 in 4 adults in that age bracket take statins now, but this study was saying maybe half, nearly half, should. So we come to this week and the new studies out that are being described as supporting this high level of statin use. What do the new studies say, Melissa?
Well, the new studies basically suggest that if physicians routinely implemented the new guidelines, if they identified all the people that the guidelines say should be considered for medication with statins, that over 10 years, between 41,000 and 63,000 heart attacks and strokes could be prevented.
In other words, it works.
In other words, it works. Now, the other study, there was a second study also published by JAMA this week, and it did a very complex calculation. It looked at how many people needed to be medicated with statins to prevent one stroke or one heart attack, and at what cost. And the study authors, who were from the Harvard School of Public Health, were asking whether it makes economic sense to treat so many people for high cholesterol, especially since we know that many, many of those people are never going to go on to suffer a heart attack or stroke. In the end, they concluded that, yes, it did make economic sense, and in fact, as public health campaigns go, it's a pretty good deal.
Cost-effective, then, and it would save lives, and yet there's been so much controversy about this. When the new recommendations first came out a couple of years ago, we had doctors saying, the critics of it saying it would just benefit the pharmaceutical industry more than anybody else, pointing out that statins have side effects and can have a downside. Is the medical community picking up these recommendations and running with them, Melissa? If I go into the doctor's office and I fall in that percentage, are they likely to say, yes, you, get on statins?
Well, you know, many people have always seen the effort to expand the patient population on statins as a sort of a conspiracy by drug companies in cahoots with cardiologists to build the market for their products by medicating pretty much everyone, or at least half of the American population. The thing is that these medications have largely all gone generic, so they're pretty inexpensive, and the pharmaceutical companies that made them are not profiting nearly as much as at least they did initially. The notion of a conspiracy probably isn't quite as strong an argument mm-hmm. these days. And again, the scientific consensus seems to be growing that, you know, statin use saves a lot of lives. But the problem is, of course, that you have to medicate a lot of healthy people, seemingly healthy people, people who might never go on to have a heart attack or stroke. You have to medicate them for their whole lives. And, you know, statins do have downsides. They do have side effects. And, you know, a lot of patients want nothing to do with them.
Side effects like what? Greater vulnerability to diabetes, sometimes muscle problems?
Correct. Yeah, the muscle problems and the muscle fatigue and pain is a particularly powerful one. It happens to a relatively small number of patients who take statins, but of course, again, as the population of people who are taking statins grows, more people have those side effects, and there has been a bit of a patient backlash over that.
Melissa Healy, you're terrific, and we appreciate your joining us today from the LA Times. Thanks a lot for being with us, Melissa.
My pleasure.
Here's one fellow who has dealt with some heart issues, changed his life, diet, and lifestyle to improve his heart health. Bill Clinton talking with David Letterman in 2011.
And then when I dropped that vein and had to have the stents put in, I just decided I'd like to hang around, see if I become a grandfather, or do a few other things. And so I changed my diet to try to drastically cut down on my cholesterol intake so this would never happen again.
I don't know if Bill Clinton's on statins, but he has clearly, we can all see, changed his diet since the old two-fisted cheeseburger days in the White House. Let's go deeper on statins and heart health. From Chicago, Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones joins us, board-certified cardiologist, director of Northwestern University's Clinical and Translational Science Institute, chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine there. He helped craft the guidelines put out in 2013 by the American College of Cardiology and the Heart Association, encouraging much wider use of statins. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you.
Do you feel some, justification here in the research that's out this week? Is it putting wind in the sails of the recommendations you and others made 2 years ago?
Well, you know, sure, I think it is. But I think it's also important to recognize that those recommendations weren't just pulled out of thin air. The results of the guidelines came out of a process that was years long, where we were examining the very best scientific evidence and the highest quality evidence to understand who benefits from statins, but also who might have adverse effects from them. So, these data that were just published, I think one might say, are a little bit predictable, but I think they are important evidence that we were on the right track in this guideline process.
If
I could just take mm-hmm. a quick second, because I'd push back a little bit or quibble a little bit with the characterization that the guidelines say that half of American adults 40 to 75 should be on a statin. I think what we really said was we identified four groups of adults that clearly benefit from statins and what we called net clinical benefit. That is, the likelihood we were going to prevent a heart attack or a stroke outweighed the likelihood of an adverse effect from the medication. And those four groups just very quickly were people mm-hmm. who've already had a heart attack or stroke, people who have a very high level of bad cholesterol, indicating a genetic problem. People who have diabetes in this age of 40 to 75. And there's really no controversy about those three groups. They should clearly be taking a statin because they're at such high risk and have demonstrated benefit. Mm-hmm. The fourth group, which I think we're really talking about today, is people who are asymptomatic. They don't yet have cardiovascular disease or diabetes. They don't have a genetic problem. But because of their collaboration, if you will, or their constitution of blood pressure levels, their blood sugar levels, they might have smoked, whether they have a family history, what their age and sex and race are, putting those things all together, the cholesterol level for them is too high and it puts them at risk. And from the trials that we reviewed, it was clear that at a 10-year risk of 7.5% or higher, that's a net benefit group. And so what we said in the guideline was those people should be considered for statin therapy as potentially eligible because they're in that net benefit group. But then we said a really important thing, which was, don't just mail a prescription to those patients. Have a conversation with them. Now we have to individualize the evidence and say, well, given your specific situation, what are the potential benefits? What are the potential harms, perhaps because you're taking other medications that might interact? And importantly, what are your patient preferences? What are your preferences about taking a pill every day to prevent something that might never happen, but you're in a higher risk group where it certainly could happen, shorten your life or limit your quality of life?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push for more Americans, a lot more, to take statins, Lipitor, Zocor, the generics, to control cholesterol, and the pushback on that. Dr. David Newman joins us in a moment. He's a critic of the statin path. Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones is with us from Northwestern School of Medicine in Chicago. He was involved in putting together the recommendations in 2013 that said a lot more Americans, in effect, ought to be on statins, joins us today from Chicago. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, I'm reading here that about one in four adults 40 to 75 now take statins. Study last year, and I understand you may quibble some, but you know, they said if everybody who met the guidelines took them, it would be almost half. Why is the level of people taking statins so far below the level that your recommendations might suggest would be appropriate?
Well, so that I think that's a fair question. You know, first of all, it's got to be emphasized that we should never be introducing a medication until we've done everything we possibly can with lifestyle. And that means, you know, really pushing on a healthy eating pattern, getting people away from their screens and up out of their chairs and moving. And that has to be the assumption that we're going to do everything we can first. And only then, I think, should we be considering a medication that somebody would have to take every day in order to prevent something when they're currently asymptomatic. So, you know, I think that has to be the basic assumption of this discussion. But beyond that, you know, I think a lot of other things, this is where the art of medicine really comes into play. We know that it takes a while for practitioners to adopt things, even when there's very strong evidence. That is a lag time that I think is unfortunate. But I think there's also, you know, an adoption cycle for patients to understand, you know, what is the safety here? What are the benefits that I could see as an individual rather than, you know, sort of these group effects that we see in the trials? You know, what will accrue to me in terms of healthier life, longer life, and better quality of life? And I think those are very important questions to consider when we're talking about any preventive therapy.
Can I ask you about on statins, if these guidelines kick in when people turn 40, and let's say somebody starts on statins at age 40, and what, the average lifespan is 80-something. I mean, they could be on these for 40 or 50 years. Is there a known effect of taking whatever it might be, the generics or Crestor, Zocor, for decades and decades?
Yeah, it's a great question, and there's sort of two ways to answer this. Actually, what we've learned, again, from careful studies is that it turns out the earlier you start them, the more benefit you get over time, interestingly enough. But we also know, you know, statins, the very earliest statins were approved in 1988, so they've been around for not quite 30 years. The safety signal continues to be extremely good from these medications. There are really no long-term irreversible side effects of statins. So that's reassuring. But that said, you know, I agree. I'm always very cautious if I'm looking at a younger patient and we're thinking about a lifetime of therapy. You know, what are the benefits that are going to accrue to them in the near term and perhaps over that lifespan? So, you know, I think that's a very important conversation to have with our patients. And there's no more important conversation because, as you pointed out, you know, 30% of us are going to die of cardiovascular disease, many of those prematurely, many of those without prior symptoms. And 60% of us in this country are going to have a major cardiovascular event before we die. The vast majority of those are preventable. So there's no more important conversation people should be having with their doctors.
I want to bring on a critic, David Newman, in just a moment. But this question for you first. If your recommendations, the study last year found, would mean almost half of Americans, 40 to 75 on statins, does that mean that as a nation, we have just colossally failed to change our eating habits and our exercise habits? Is that the evidence? If half of us, as we age, have to be medicated not to have heart disease, does it mean we're just raging failure on the diet and exercise front?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, great.
Unfortunately, but absolutely true. There's no doubt about it. You know, we know that if people adopt very healthy lifestyles as, you know, kids and young adults, they can preserve really good risk factor levels and overall cardiovascular health through to middle age and later. And they have much greater longevity. They're much healthier, much longer. But unfortunately, far fewer than 5% of Americans get to age 50 with optimal risk factor levels. So, you know, we must change our society. We must change our public health approaches. No question about that. But until we do that, and that's a hard nut to crack, until we do that, we have a huge amount of risk in the population that we're going to have to deal with. And medications for many of those patients are going to be an important way to reduce that risk and prolong their lives.
So get moving, people, and eat your greens. We've got a lot of callers for you, and I promise I will come to them, but I want to hear a little pushback first on the statin front. Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones at Northwestern School of Medicine, please stand by there in Chicago. With us now from New York, Dr. David Newman, Director of the Clinical Research and Professor of Emergency Medicine at the School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, author of Hippocrates' Shadow, What Doctors Don't Know, Don't Tell You, and How Truth Can Repair the Patient-Doctor Breach. He also writes the medical blog at the Huffington Post, editor-in-chief of the NNT. It's a website that helps patients look up the effectiveness of different treatments. Dr. David Newman, welcome to On Point. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
So you have written, I saw one column by you called the headline, The Statin Insanity. You're looking at lots of drugs and maybe over-prescription. This one in particular, and maybe in particular since the 2013 guidelines that Dr. Lloyd-Jones was involved with came out. And here this week we have research out support, which is being interpreted as supporting the need for very widespread statin use among Americans 40 and up. What do you say?
Well, there's a whole lot to talk about here, obviously. It's an interesting topic, and there are points of agreement that are important. I think, you know, among people who are known to have heart disease, for instance, who are at a very high risk of having a cardiac event of some sort, it would appear that statins have a very reasonable harm-benefit profile. There's more benefit than harm in those patients. When we start talking about that group where we're at lower risk, which is where all the controversy is, that's where things diverge a little bit. And just to step back a little bit, I think it'd be worth doing a little bit of big picture here for a second. It's worth knowing, and I think most people don't know this. In fact, most of the physicians I work with don't know, that if you take the data that we have on people who sort of show up to a hospital with their first ever heart attack, you can look at the United States data on this, and you can see that roughly three quarters of those people having their first ever heart attack do not have elevated cholesterols. So if you target cholesterol as your public health strategy for trying to prevent somebody's first ever heart attack, you've already dropped three out of four people who we need to be targeting. We did talk a little bit about lifestyle stuff, and that's another point of important agreement. We happen to know that there's excellent randomized trial data carefully done that would suggest that Mediterranean diet is in the range of 2 to 3 times more powerful than any statin drug or almost any other cardiovascular drug that's ever been developed. So a Mediterranean diet, you know, which is I mean, to me, it always feels like a vacation on the Riviera. It's not really a diet per se. It's a lot of olive oil, have a glass of wine with
enjoy
dinner
it.
Each night, you know, enjoy it. Yeah. It's, so those are things that we agree on. And then when we get to that low risk group, the thing that's important to remember about these studies and the thing that is important to remember about the AHA guidelines is that what they're looking at is a very population-based approach. And looking at a population-based approach is a very reasonable way to try and understand what would happen in a population if everybody was on statins or fewer people were, et cetera.
Okay.
But in the exam room, it's a whole different question. In the exam room, what a patient and a doctor want to know is how likely is it that this patient in front of me or that this person is going to actually benefit from the statin, and how likely is it that they're going to be harmed? And if you take that low-risk group that we've been talking about and you simply look at the trials, the good randomized trials that have been done on this, not the recent studies, which are essentially statistical gymnastics around population health. If you actually look at the trials, what you find is that the chances that a person with a low risk who hasn't had a heart attack in the past, chances that they're going to actually be prevented from having a heart attack by taking a statin for 5 years' time, daily and religiously, about 1 in 100 or so. There's also about a 1 in 100 chance that that statin is going to give them diabetes. So you're talking about a harm-benefit balance that's very, very tricky, and it would appear that that statin is not going to save their life, because in the low-risk categories, it doesn't seem to be life-saving as a therapy, or if it is life-saving, it's so small that we couldn't find it so far in 130,000 people in trials. So there's probably no life-saving benefit. It might prevent heart attacks, but if it does, for the individual patient, it seems to be about as likely to give them diabetes, which is a lifelong problem, versus preventing a single heart attack or a stroke.
Dr. Lloyd-Jones, what about that interpretation? Do you have any second thoughts about how far the 2013 recommendations pushed the recommendation for statin use into that lower risk group?
No, and actually I would strongly disagree with many of the interpretations I heard there from Dr. Newman. I think he's cherry-picking a lot of the data there. And I think most importantly, he completely missed what the guidelines said. The guidelines are not about elevated cholesterol. He's exactly right. Most people who have heart attacks don't have, quote, elevated cholesterol. They have pretty average levels of cholesterol. And it's not about the cholesterol. It's about the risk. You can't interpret the cholesterol number absent the entire global risk profile that includes things like blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, status, age, sex, and race.
You've got an online calculator where people can look at that risk. There's a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, and it's got a lot more than cholesterol going on.
Exactly. So while statins work by reducing the LDL or bad cholesterol, what they're doing is reducing risk. And that's the key point here, is we can't just look at one number and decide, are you at risk or not? We have to look at the whole picture. And statins are, in fact, among the most effective things we have to reduce overall risk, even among these lower risk so-called primary prevention groups.
What about the diabetes risk that Dr. Newman points to?
Yeah, very important, very important thing to point out. So, you know, our calculations looking at all the literature, not cherry-picking numbers, would say that actually the 10-year risk for developing diabetes is about 1 in 100 for people put on a moderate-dose statin, and the 10-year risk for people put on a high-intensity statin is about 1 in 33. The corresponding benefit numbers that we calculated were actually preventing about for one patient, one heart attack prevented for about every 40 patients treated with moderate intensity and about every 25 patients treated with high intensity statins. So we disagree on the numbers here. I'd stick by our numbers because these are done by independent groups like the Cochrane Group showing and not just preventing heart attacks and strokes, preventing total mortality. You know, I would push back a lot on that. As far as diabetes goes, nobody gets created into a diabetic out of whole cloth by being put on a statin. These are people who are on the fast track to diabetes already. A few of them may have their blood sugar bumped a little bit by being put on a statin, so they cross that magic threshold for diabetes. Lifestyle is the answer here. One really good study looked at this and said, by being put on a statin, the date of diagnosis of diabetes was accelerated by not years, not months, 5.4 weeks. These were people who were already on the fast track to diabetes, and the statin push them over that magic diagnostic threshold, but it didn't really change the situation. And by the way, they're getting more benefit from being on the statin by preventing heart attacks and strokes, especially when they have diabetes.
Dr. David Newman, Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones, please stand by. Lots of questions online and on the phone lines here. Louise in Saint-Armand in Quebec, Canada. Louise, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. To me, it's a comment. I'm 71 years old, and 3 years ago, I had the symptoms. So I went, and they thought everything was wrong. The ECG and the blood work was really bad, and they told me I should have an angiogram ASAP.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I did not have any cardiovascular disease, and what I did, he had put me on a high dose of Lipitor. I said, no, I'm not going to take that big dose. I'll change my lifestyle. And what I did is I tackled with exercise, nutrition, but also meditation, fighting the stress. I'm a big believer that stress really screws up or in a positive way, if you relax, the whole body. So I think there are things that the science does not know about how the whole thing connects with each other. And so far, I've gone back and I reduced it to 5 milligrams a day. He wanted me to be on 40,
mm-hmm.
and I'm fine. All the blood work is fine. So that's what I want to see. So pushing pills and not pushing, you know, the overall picture, including the stress. I don't think it's going to get nowhere.
Louise, you sound very wise. I might take you as a guide on this. I appreciate your call. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, let's say you go into the doctor's office. You're not at super high risk, but you're in there, and they say statin time. If you instead walk out, go to the gym and to the produce section of the grocery and just, you know, start exercising and start eating very healthily, can you get the same effect without going on the statin? Can you duck it?
Yeah, it's a great question, and certainly it depends on who you are, where you're starting in that sort of risk spectrum as to whether that's enough. But, you know, I think many patients, if they're really religious about adopting a healthier lifestyle with a healthier eating pattern and participating in more physical activity, I think many of them can achieve the same benefits that they could get from a statin. The question is, in our society, how often does that happen? As a practicing preventive cardiologist, I'm sorry to say it's not as often as I'd like it to be.
Dr. Newman, if statins, we look at the downside. If people aren't going to get off the couch and they're not going to change their diets often enough, is the downside really so serious? And the new study says, look, it's cost effective. You know, why not? Is the downside that deep? Even you say it's 1 in 100 diabetes chance. Nobody wants to get that. But is the downside so severe?
Well, I think the question that people have in the exam room, the thing that they're always trying to figure out is whether the benefits trump the harms, right? I mean,
yep.
If the downside is small, 1 in 100, and the upside and the benefits are high, I think everybody would agree. Everybody would be on the same page. Unfortunately, what's happened with a lot of the statin data is that people sort of use populations and take certain slices of data, and the data that we have is actually skewed very, very strongly towards the people who are at the sickest sort of end of the spectrum. Dr. Lloyd-Jones mentioned the Cochrane sort of reviews, and the Cochrane group is a group that does a lot of statin data reviews.
Mm-hmm.
The source data that they use is the CTT reviews. And the CTT reviews, when you look at their breakdowns, the people in the lowest risk categories, they really didn't get more benefit than harm. They got more harm than benefit. And those are meticulous breakdowns. So I think that's the thing that we all weigh.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push for more Americans to take statins to avoid cardiovascular disease, heart disease. Of course, that is the number one killer of Americans. New studies out this week said to support 2013 guidelines that would have a lot more Americans taking statins. About one in four, age 40 to 75, do now. If the guidelines were fully followed, that might be almost half of Americans in that age group. Maybe you're on them already. Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones is with us from Northwestern School of Medicine. He was part of the group that helped put out those recommendations in 2013 from the American College of Cardiology, the American Heart Association. Dr. David Newman is with us from the School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York, critic of overprescription and including overprescription of statins. Don's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My experience was about 20 years ago, my cholesterol went up from a little higher than you'd like the 200s to over 400. My triglycerides got too high to measure.
Nothing 400? What were you eating, Don? Was it pork rinds all day long? What was going on?
No, it was better than average diet, and I went to a vegetarian diet.
Okay.
No effect.
Okay.
Zero.
Wow.
And I was kind of a borderline, back then I was kind of a borderline exercise fanatic.
Yep.
Not so much now at 57.
Yep.
But most of the statins also had no effect, but they finally found one of the more obscure ones, lovastatin, brought it down, and also added a triglyceride medicine, brought the triglycerides down to a decent level, brought cholesterol down to like 110 or so. Lately, it gotten a little lower, maybe a little lower than they want to see it, like about 90.
So a huge decline, a very big decline.
The only thing that worked.
Let me ask about that.
It took a lot of experimentation to find that. You know, this was actually kind of near the bottom of the list of statins, you know, most of them had no effect.
Don, I'm glad that number is down, and I hope it stays there for you and your health stays good. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, what about this issue of a specific statin working for a specific individual? How much does that match matter?
Well, I think it's a really important concept, and you know, I would agree we need to match the data from large populations, bring them into the room with the patient and understand how it affects this particular individual in their specific situation. And this is a great example of that, I would say, where because of different genetic makeups, different environmental or behavioral habits and dietary factors, some patients will respond better to one drug than another. So we have to do what we call these N of one trials. That is, you know, there's one person in this trial, it's this patient, and find the thing that's going to work best for them with the most efficacy and the least side effects.
Let's go to Marcia in Newton, Massachusetts. Marcia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I would just like to talk about the generic drug argument. I do not buy that argument that Big Pharma is not behind the push to increase people on statins.
And let me just clarify, Marcia, you're saying that when they were branded like Lipitor and so on, and there's pretty high profit margin on that, generics now are less expensive, I suppose less profit on that. But how do you see that all playing out, Marcia?
Okay, so I think that now the big pharma wants to get more and more people on them, because let's face it, for any product, if your profit is 5 cents and you sell 10 of them, you're not going to make much. But if your profit is 5 cents and you're selling 8 million of them over a lot of years, that is not too shabby of a profit margin for big pharma.
So the fact that they've gone generic, you see as a motivation to prescribe them to a whole lot more people. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, what about you and the others who helped come out with these recommendations? Do you have financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry?
I have none and have not had any for over a decade. Prior to that, I was a participant, randomizing mm-hmm. patients into some of these trials, but I didn't receive any money for that either. I'm a scientist, and I think Big Pharma was not in the room with us when we were looking at the evidence of these trials and how they affect individuals and improve outcomes or not. We hear this a lot. I get it. I totally understand it. And there's no question that actually pharma really is the major funder of these trials, but that's because government won't fund them. So, I don't think we can fully indict them. It's a problem. We must be transparent about the role of pharma in understanding guideline development. But in these particular guidelines, it was not an issue.
Marcia, I'm with you, though, in keeping our antenna up there. Herb in Simsbury, Connecticut. Herb, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. You're a marvelous person. My wife and I enjoy your program. I got off statins because somebody at my health club said that it was causing a problem in my aerobics class. They told me it was causing a problem with them, and they got off it, and they found a drastic improvement in their health below particularly it's a leg situation with me.
Like what?
The minute I got off it.
Joints or muscle or what, Herb?
Yeah, muscles, joints, everything. It was just destroyed me. And the minute I got off it, the improvement happened like overnight. And it's getting better and better. But I chalked that up to almost destroying my life.
Herb, keep your diet good. I'm glad you're feeling better. Dr. Newman, here's another one online. Floyd says, side effects with a lot of exclamation marks. Talk about how atorvastatin, for instance, can devour your connective tissue. I nearly lost the use of an arm before I dug hard enough to figure out what was going on. My doctor, useless, too busy. He just prescribes and prescribes whatever Big Pharma tells him to. What about side effects when it comes to connective tissue, joints, I guess, and muscle? You raised diabetes, Dr. Newman. Are there other issues that people should keep an eye on here?
So the muscle issue is actually it's nearly ubiquitous with the statins. Unfortunately, it's one of those things that's not well tracked in the industry-funded trials, probably partly because they're industry-funded and there's less in it for them to closely track this kind of stuff. But it turns out that when you look at post-marketing surveillance data, somewhere in the range of, you know, 1 in 5, 1 in 3 people is going to have significant side effects that make them stop the statin, and about 1 in 10 is going to have some form of muscle damage or muscle pain. So it is incredibly common. And I feel like I have to mention, in addition, you know, your caller brought up the issue of Big Pharma, and Dr. Lloyd-Jones, you know, says that pharma wasn't in the room for the AHA guidelines. And I don't know what he means by in the room or not in the room, but I think it is worth knowing that of the 15 people on the guideline that we're really talking about, 7 of them had direct financial conflicts with pharma, with Big Pharma, including the chair had a significant conflict prior to becoming the chair of the committee, and he dropped
those
conflicts. But
that's incorrect.
Well, that's from him. But I think the important thing to know is that if we talk about whether or not pharma was in the room, there were a lot of people involved that we probably ought to be transparent about who really did have direct actual financial relationships with pharma.
We hear the objection on that particular assertion. What's your recommendation, Dr. Newman, for people who don't want to have heart disease, don't want to have a heart attack, don't want to die from cardiovascular disease? You say steer clear or be very wary of statins. And yet Americans don't do the exercise and diet changes that they need to avoid these problems. What's your recommendation?
So the first thing I would say is that Dr. Lloyd-Jones and I are on the same page. I think one thing that the guidelines did that was very smart was matching risk to therapy. And if we could do that in the exam room on an individual scale rather than a population scale, we'd be able to figure out who gets the biggest bang for the buck. It starts with Mediterranean diet and other lifestyle interventions, and then it moves to things like statins when you're in a very high-risk category, and it's reasonable then. When you're not in a very high-risk category, it's unequivocally not a great choice.
Americans left with a lot of tough decisions here. That exam room experience, as some of our listeners are posting online here, that can be an awful quick move-it-along experience as well. Nevertheless, we learn a lot from this conversation. We're grateful to the two of you, Dr. David Newman at the School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, author of Hippocrates' Shadow. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Newman.
Thank you.
And Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones, Senior Associate Dean for Clinical and Translational Research at Northwestern School of Medicine, Chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine there. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, thank you so much for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
In a moment, we will look at Colorado's success in reducing teen pregnancy with long-term birth control. This is On Point. For the last 6 years, Colorado has offered free long-term birth control devices to teenagers and poor women to help prevent unwanted and teen pregnancies. By the numbers, the program has been a huge success. The birth rate among teenagers in Colorado down 40%. Teen abortions about the same. To look at Colorado's push to reduce teen pregnancies, I'm joined by Sabrina Tavernisi, science correspondent for the New York Times. Sabrina, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So what did Colorado do that came up with these great reductions in teen pregnancy?
So Colorado had a very large grant from the Susan Buffett Foundation, the late wife of Warren Buffett, the billionaire.
Yep. And
essentially what they did was they, for clinics across the state, they sort of had the money allowed the clinics to stock up on these devices, which readers might not know exactly what they are. There was a long-acting device, meaning an IUD, an intrauterine device that was came on the market in the 1970s called the Dalcon Shield, and that had everyone had very bad experiences with that. It turned out not to be a good device, and so people had this memory of, you know, IUDs and these kind of long-term devices that would be inserted as something that was sort of perhaps bad or dangerous. But the modern devices are quite different, and the state decided to take it upon itself to really push the use of this device among low-income women and teenagers. Those are the women who disproportionately have unplanned pregnancies, and see if that would change the rate of unplanned pregnancies, and in fact they found that it did.
Describe the devices to us. What are they? How do they work? Who got them?
So it's a very interesting question. I really didn't know very much about them before I started. And, you know, I remember sort of, you know, the pill and birth control as sort of being kind of an old-fashioned thing. These, the most popular devices are implants. It's called the Nexplanon, but it's basically a little implant. It's a little hard plastic rod that's sort of painted different colors. Mm-hmm. And it's actually inserted under the skin of the upper arm. And that was very popular among teenagers because, you know, a lot of them had never had a pelvic exam, a gynecological exam before in their lives. This was sort of something that, you know, kind of you just put a Band-Aid on it after you walk out of the doctor's office. There's sort of a device that the doctor uses to insert it. It looks almost like a stapler, kind of.
How long does it work?
It works for up to 3 years. So it's a very long time. So really, you know, it's a profound change in terms of the lives of young women. It's essentially kind of sets the default for life to not pregnant.
At what age would Colorado teenagers be eligible, I guess is the right word, to have the implant?
So in Colorado, there is part of the law is that they can do it confidentially, the teenagers. They don't have to tell their parents. And that, you know, people argue with that, but that is essentially the law in Colorado.
From what age, Sabrina?
Can
a 13-year-old walk in and get one of these? A 15-year-old?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly what if that's in statute or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly saw 15-year-olds. I never saw anyone as early as 13. Presumably that's possible. But I think for me, the biggest, you know, one of the there's a big argument in the United States about inequality right now, poverty, and one of the ways to reduce that for young women is to allow them to choose when they actually want to have a baby, as opposed to have that be an accident. These devices were really sort of allowing that to happen. So, for example, in Colorado, before the program started, if you take all of the poorest areas of the state, half of all births in those areas were to women younger than 21.
Mm-hmm.
After the program, half of all births in those areas were to women 24. Younger than 24. So really it had bumped up the age of first births to poor women to, you know, 3 years, which is enough time to finish college, maybe try to sort of get a foothold in some sort of a career. So it really was it's a big change from, you know, the way birth control worked before, which is that, you know, there was so much human error. You know, sometimes you forget to take your pill and sometimes you're not protected.
Is this seen by its backers as a model for the country? Is that how it's being promoted?
It was. They were very enthusiastically promoting it. In fact, there were a number of states also, other states that Colorado was sort of teaching about this, talking about their experience, talking about having trained doctors, and talking about how to kind of spread something like this around. So a number of states were involved in kind of conferencing with Colorado and trying to figure out how they did it.
What about pushback from those who might say, I mean, I remember the billboards that went up talking about, say, look, they're trying to, historically, some of these groups, low-income people and others, were sterilized. And then there are critics who say they're trying to control the population of certain parts of the country. And on the other hand, this is also the exact opposite of the abstinence movement. 3 years of free and clear sex as a teenager. That's right. A long way from abstinence. Has there been pushback on either of those fronts?
Right. No, that's a great question. Yeah, the sterilization sort of stain, historical stain, mm-hmm. was something that was present, I think. I think that's sort of one of the reasons why it's a little bit, people are a little bit hesitant to really kind of talk about this as this kind of from the inequality perspective of, a solution for poor women, because obviously there's a historical taint there. In terms of the abstinence movement, there wasn't, I'm sure that there were, those arguments had been made. I think politically the bigger opposition was simply that the devices, Colorado was asking for, the grant was running out and Colorado was asking for some funding from the state legislature, and they ultimately did not get it because of several Republicans on a key committee that said that they believed that it was abortifacient, some types of the devices. So that argument still, even though scientifically it's pretty dubious, that argument is still kind of was the main political sticking point.
Well, there's a no-duh element. Give 3-year birth control and teen pregnancy is going to go down. How much more widely that would be applied, we'll see. Sabrina Tavernisi at the New York Times, thank you so much, Sabrina. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.